This is the other question of why we have this antiquated electoral college that allows somebody to become president when he was the loser to the popular vote. We have somebody who won 2.7 million more votes than the declared winner. And, you know, this is we need to abolish the electoral college. We need to get big money out of politics. We need to deal with gerrymandering. We need a lot of improvement, all hands on deck for fighting for our democracy.
John Bonifacio, I want to thank you for being with us, founder of the National Voting Rights Institute, co-founder of President Free Speech for People. A very happy birthday to Carla Wills, Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gutestein, Dina Gester, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman with Nirmin Shu.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO Benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue in Portland. KBOO and Elysian Brewing will celebrate the release of the Manic IPA series with hip-hop, funk, and electronica spun by The Pariahs, DJ Dakimba, and Vinology. Again, that's Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO Benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue, 3341 Southeast Belmont Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, listeners. Due to the holidays, the December KBOO board meeting has been canceled. But don't worry, because we're going to have a makeup meeting between now and the next scheduled board meeting in January. You can go to kboo.fm for more information, or just tune into KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, it's cold. We'll check in with Ibrahim Mubarak of Right to Dream 2 about the availability of winter shelters for the homeless and the future of the embattled downtown camp.
An earthquake off the California coast caused no damage or injuries, but was felt as far north as the southern Oregon coast.
And we'll hear an update from Standing Rock, where temperatures have hit a negative 20 degrees.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 8th, 2016. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Whenever it snows in Portland, people are affected strongly due to how infrequently it occurs. The hardest hit, however, are the homeless segment of the population. KBOO reporter Joe Lino spoke with homeless advocate Ibrahim Mubarak, co-founder of Dignity Village and Right to Dream 2, and founder of Right to Survive, about the adequacy of shelters.
During Portland's rare but significant snow days, such as today, media outlets have a tendency to warn people to just hunker down in their houses rather than venture out into the streets. What are the hunker down options for the houseless population in Portland on snowy days such as today?
Well, unfortunately, it's over 3,000 people that sleep out on the street every day in Portland. And the city officials have been listening to the houseless and housing advocates and activists, and they're starting to open up warming centers. However, I don't think that's enough. I think it should be organized campsites where they can warm their own self up, because when people say it's not cold enough to open a warming shelter, then those are the people that live inside. Those are not the people that are living outside that's cold every single minute of their life being on the street. Because those people can walk out and say, oh, it's not that cold, but then they can go back in when they do, but the houseless people can't go back in nowhere. So what they do is they try to find the warmest place, and if it's a vacant building and they go in there to stay warm, I don't blame them. Or if it's an abandoned car, I don't blame them doing that neither. However, we shouldn't fault those people that's trying to survive in the street. We should look at the politicians and the way this government lash out and bash people that don't live in an apartment or in a house.
Does the weather have to get as bad as it is today for the Army shelters to open?
Well, they should be open now, but they usually have to be 35 degrees on down in order for them to open up warming shelters. But what the general public don't realize, if you're out in that cold and it's raining on you constantly, that's create more coldness, and that dampness give you, you know, that's how a lot of people get flu or pneumonia, or some even die from hypothermia because other people don't think it's that cold for them. They look listening to themselves, and they're not listening to the people that's affected and living out in the street. How can a city say that it's environmental friendly and for environmental justice when it's constantly letting the environment kill the people out in the street?
How adequate or inadequate would you say the number of resources and shelters are correlated against the need for them?
I believe it's not adequate enough for shelters. And then if a person do make it in a shelter, they only got a limited amount of time to be in that shelter before they push back out into the rain. So I think it should be 24-hour shelter, like Right to Dream 2, Dignity Village, Hazelnut Grove, Sedan Browns, and Camp Amanda.
You brought up Right to Dream 2. It was recently announced that it's going to face eviction. Is there anything you can tell us about that? Is that a for sure thing? Is there a timeline?
It's a for sure thing. It's been coming for 5 years. We signed a 5-year lease with the landowner, and he's been most cordial and hospitable towards us and very, very lenient. However, our lease ends in April, and so by him realizing the city is doing limited to help us find a new location. And when we do find a new location, they come up with all these zoning and coding crap that they should have known about, which stagnating our progress. And he's just trying to help the public be aware on what's happening, that he may be forced to be the bad guy because the city is helping us inadequately.
Do you and the landlord think that by announcing the coming eviction, it may speed things up with the city finding another adequate place?
Well, since that announcement, we haven't met with the city, and we're supposed to meet today, but due to the weather, City Hall happened to close down. However, I've been getting tons of texts, phone calls, emails, people visiting, asking what's going on, can they support us, let them know if anything they can do. So the support is largely, hugely there. If you have any extra money left from buying your loved one Christmas gift, see if you can buy a sleeping bag, some hand warmer socks or a blanket, or something to go down and give the people that's not able to afford the high rate of rent and housing and they're sleeping out in the street. Or make some hot chocolate or tea or coffee or something to go down there and talk to them, make them feel welcome.
Thanks for your time.
No problem. Thank you. Bye now.
This is Joe Alino with KBOO News.
President-elect Donald Trump today announced his pick for Secretary of Labor, Andrew Puzder, CEO of the company that owns the Hardee's and Carl's Jr. fast food chains. Puzder opposes significant increases in the minimum wage and any expansion to who qualifies for overtime pay. He supports rolling back the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, despite the fact that many fast food workers rely on it for access to health care. Puzder is widely reported to have earned nearly $4.5 million in 2012, and is yet another example of CEOs making millions while their workers can't afford the basics. But a new measure passed yesterday right here in Portland aims to rein in that disparity. I filed this report today for Free Speech Radio News. The City Council of Portland, Oregon has approved a first-of-its-kind surtax on businesses with gaping income inequality between their highest and lowest paid workers. Companies with CEOs who make more than 100 times the salary of their lowest earning employees will pay a 10% higher city tax rate. That percentage jumps to 25% if a chief executive earns more than 250 times the pay of workers on a company's bottom rung. Once it came up on the City Council agenda Wednesday evening, the measure passed in less than 3 minutes, with council members each giving brief statements as they voted. Here's Portland Mayor Charlie Hales speaking ahead of his vote in favor.
Big problems of our time, climate, race relations, income inequality, are being addressed by cities. It probably should be a federal priority, and I hope someday it is. But right now, it falls to cities to do creative, progressive policymaking, and that's exactly what this is.
The bill's sponsor, City Commissioner Steve Novick, said his intent was to spark a national debate on how to address rising income inequality, and that he hopes other cities will take up similar measures. The tax rates are due to take effect in the coming year after the Securities and Exchange Commission begins publishing data on the ratio between CEO compensation and median worker pay. Sam Bowman, FSRN, Portland.
Radiation from the 2011 disaster at the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan has been detected on Oregon's coast. Samples taken last winter from Tillamook Bay in the north and Gold Beach in the south were finally tested by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Woods Hole says the seawater samples show the presence of radiation from Fukushima, but not at levels that pose any threat to humans or the environment. The Fukushima Daiichi plant was disabled after a massive earthquake struck the northeast of Japan in 2011. The quake and ensuing tsunami killed nearly 16,000 people, with 2,500 still missing. Along with the ensuing nuclear meltdowns, the event is described by Japanese leaders as the worst crisis in the country since World War II. Nobody was killed directly in the meltdowns, but scientists variously estimate that between 130 and 640 people will eventually die from cancers caused by the disaster. The radiation traveling by water was first detected in North America last year on the shores of Vancouver Island.
Portland residents love shopping local, and for those who also like supporting local artists, the first annual East Portland Holiday Bazaar has got your holiday shopping covered. That's bizarre as in how bizarre, how bizarre. Artists and crafters from the east side of Portland will be showing off their art and goods, while also helping to build awareness of local artists that aren't usually featured at our larger crafting fairs. KBOO News spoke with East Portland Holiday Bazaar organizer Amisa Chiu to talk about the event and about supporting Eastside artists.
This is the first annual East Portland Holiday Bazaar, and it's a special thing because it's going to be located in East Portland, where a lot of times the art is focused more in like inner southeast or downtown. So we're really trying to pull it out. East Portland Holiday Bazaar is going to be on 82nd Street, and it's going to be a one-day holiday market where people can find pretty affordable, local, handmade holiday gifts. And it's going to be an all-day event this Saturday, where free and family-friendly, where people can really buy local.
Who are some of the vendors that are going to be featured at the bazaar?
Yeah, so this year we are really trying to center and feature artists of color, especially artists of color living on the east side, but also artists who are local to the east side. And so a lot of times when I'm thinking about the east side, the outer east side at least, it's kind of those who are around 82nd and beyond, right? And so a lot of times those artists aren't really featured in Portland proper or are not centered. And so a lot of our vendors are coming locally. They're independent artists who live and work around 82nd Street and beyond. So, for example, one of our artists is Erica Ryer, who makes illustrated textiles and hand silk screened prints and jewelry and things like that. And her daughter, Isadora, is actually one of our youth, our few youth vendors. She's 13, and she makes her a handmade, yarn poofle crowns. Another one of our vendors is Icho, who's an artist who is a mural artist, and he's done a lot of murals in Northeast Portland. I guess you would say that he has kind of a street style, graffiti style, artwork style. We have Sashiko Yoon coming in. Sashiko is an artist who does very cute and grotesque artwork. So it's very fanciful and featuring very fierce women of color, but also a lot of times these people that she's illustrating are kind of have like a macabre feel to it, like a little bit of horror with the sweetness to it. And so she's one of our feature artists. So I'm partnering with Sprightly Bean, and Yoon Poole and I are partnering together to create this holiday bazaar. And the thing about it that we were really trying to focus on is this community building aspect and really supporting our local artists, kind of taking the smaller concept of a craft fair and really kind of trying to create something larger than that. So just maybe even so, this holiday bazaar is beyond just a craft fair, because we're really trying to pull the community together under the guise of a holiday bazaar, but really trying to connect local artists with each other and kind of create a space for that community.
You're saying that this is the first time you guys are having this bazaar. What kind of inspired you to initiate this in the first place?
Yeah, well, I'm one of the organizers for the Portland Zine Symposium. So, and Wynn has done, she formerly owned a coffee shop called Sprightly Bean that is changing right now. But they've also hosted two annual Artist Alley Comics Festivals. And so Wynn and I are not new to this whole organizing thing, but I think we really wanted to do something in the winter because most of our festivals happen in the summertime, so to break up the year, but really trying to, like I said before, like gather these artists together. And I think the idea came about, like, we were like, oh, we want to, you know, host kind of a gathering where people can buy and sell their stuff. And then, and we were like, maybe we'll reach out to about 50 people. And so it started off with that. And it's really kind of blossomed into a much larger event. So currently we have about 120 vendors coming. And the space is the Apano Jam space, which is a large warehouse space and will fit relatively snugly. But I'm surprised on how the community responded, even though it's our first year. The community has really kind of shown up and been like, wow, we really need this. We really need it, one, on this side of town. But two, a lot of the crafters weren't getting into some of the larger craft fairs in town. And so they were feeling a little bit, one, priced out of those craft fairs because they're very expensive to participate. But also the level, I guess, of artistry, they weren't being chosen. So we're kind of trying to open up the space for new first-time crafters, youth crafters, crafters of color, artists of color, East Side, East Portland crafters.
So who should attend your event?
I really want it to be really packed with local people. And so this is the East Portland Holiday Bazaar is happening in the Jade District. So right on the corner of Division and 82nd Avenue, right across from PCC Southeast Campus. And so I really like folks living in that area to really come and support the local crafters, because we have a handful of crafters that make, live, and create right in that neighborhood. And so it would be really great if the neighborhood could show up. But also, you know, anyone is welcome to, anyone that's interested in buying local this season. I know a lot of the focus this year and years past is kind of taking our money out of big corporations and putting it to the independent creators. And so I think this is a wonderful opportunity to do that.
So if listeners want to learn more about the Holiday Bazaar and the artists who are featured, how can they learn about the details?
Yeah, so a lot of our postings and updates are happening on our Facebook page. So if you go to sprightlybean.com/holidaybazaar and you click on the flyer that pops up, it'll take you straight to our Facebook events page. And we are expecting several hundred people to come through, and we have about 120 vendors. So it's going to be a packed event. Some of the cool features of the Holiday Bazaar is that we're going to have a doggy holiday booth. So if folks are walking their dogs, you know, getting some fresh air, they can come in, take a photo with Letty Lou, who's the owner and proprietor of Forever is a Promise, a doggy daycare center in town. So we have that. We're going to have a DIY gift wrapping station. And so for a tiny fee, if you buy holiday gifts from the vendors and you want to just wrap it on the spot, we'll have a selection of some vintage wrapping paper that you can wrap it yourself and gift it yourself. So it's going to be a really fun day. We're going to have a couple of specifically focused children's illustrators and book publishers there. And so it's going to be very family friendly as well.
So that is Amisa Chu, organizer of the East Portland Holiday Bazaar, taking place this weekend from what time?
10 a.m. to 5 p.m. this Saturday, December 10th at 8114 Southeast Division Street. It's going to be in the Jade Apano Multicultural Space on the corner of Southeast Division and Southeast 82nd Avenue in the Discount Warehouse building.
Well, thank you very much, Misa, for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you, Jenna.
For the KBOO News, I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
Today at 6:50 a.m. Pacific Time, a magnitude 6.5 earthquake occurred about 100 miles off the Northern California coast near the Oregon border. Although there were no reports of injuries or damage, the quake off Eureka was felt from southern Oregon to the Bay Area. Less than 2 hours later, another quake of magnitude 5.0 hit about 108 miles off the coast of Ferndale, less than 20 miles south of Eureka. About 1 hour after the second California tremor, a magnitude 7.8 earthquake occurred near the Solomon Islands. Tsunami warnings were issued for surrounding areas, including Hawaii, but were canceled soon after without incident. There were no injuries or damage reported from the Solomon earthquake either. However, Indonesia's Aceh province was not so fortunate when 6.5 magnitude quake struck there yesterday. The latest death toll there is 102 people, with another 750 injured. 11,000 people have been left homeless due to the destruction caused by yesterday's earthquake, the worst disaster to hit the province since the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for KBOO News In-Depth at 5:45, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be downright tropical, with a high of 41, a low of 40, and plenty of rain. Today in history, in 1941, the Imperial Japanese military simultaneously and successfully invaded Malaya, Thailand, Hong Kong, the Philippines, and Indonesia, then called the Dutch East Indies, as well as the international settlement in Shanghai. The invasions also included the attack on Pearl Harbor, which technically occurred on December 7th due to the time difference. Also in 1980, John Lennon was shot to death outside of the Dakota in New York City, sparking a global outpouring of grief. The quote of the day is from Amanda McKittrick Ross, who was born on this day in 1860, widely considered one of the worst writers who ever lived. In this poem, Ross muses on the universality of death. Holy Moses, have a look. Flesh decayed in every nook. Some rare bits of brain lie here, mortal loads of beef and beer, some of whom are turned to dust. Every one bids loss to lust. Royal flesh so tinged with blue undergoes the same as you.
It's 5:21. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Actor Jack Nicholson says he finally understood the meaning of the word irony when his mother called him a son of a bitch. So let us consider Donnie Trump, who campaigned as the populist champion of the working class, promising that by gollies he was going to take on Wall Street and the corporate elites. But the bitter irony for the working class is that they now see what the SOB meant. He's literally taking on the moneyed powers by taking them on board his administration. For example, he's brought in Wall Street billionaires to fill the three top economic policy positions in his cabinet. Then there's Betsy DeVos, the billionaire heiress to the scandal-plagued Amway fortune. Her life's work has been trying to defund and privatize the public schools that working-class people count on and to eliminate the working-class jobs of teachers and support staff. Her new job with Trump? Secretary of Education, where she'll now use our public money to try killing off our public education system. And here comes Myron Ebell, a honcho of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a corporate front group funded by fossil fuel profiteers like Exxon and the Koch brothers, where he pushed relentlessly to gut the Environmental Protection Agency. Where's he now? Heading Trump's EPA transition team. Also, more than half of the Donald's Department of Defense transition team have been executives or lobbyists for such military contractors as Boeing. Overall, according to watchdog group Public Citizen, 3/4 of Trump's transition teams, which are organizing, staffing, and shaping our new government, come from corporate world. Not a single working-class populist has been allowed a seat at his power table. This is Jim Hightower saying, as America's working stiffs know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Trump is no populist. He's a full-tilt corporatist. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
As winter storms continue to hit North Dakota, many water protectors in North Dakota have decided to leave temporarily as temperatures drop into the negative 20s. We spoke with one water protector who has made two trips to Standing Rock and plans on returning, since there are lingering doubts about the pipeline construction being halted. Water protector Monty Power spoke with KBOO's Jenna Yokoyama about his experience and thoughts about the future of the crude oil pipeline.
The first time I went was in August. I stayed until October, first week. I only planned on staying for 1 week. When I got there, things changed.
What changed? What inspired you to stay longer?
I got more information about the prayer that the elders had asked that we stand behind them on the prayer that they're trying to, you know, they're using this prayer to change, you know, another man's heart, you know, this pipeline. So when I got there, I was 1 week, just wasn't enough. I put off a lot of other responsibilities at home. I should have been, you know, but Standing Rock seemed more important. You know, that's our water, our life. So I stayed with my friends, my brothers, who went out there with me. You know, 1 week just didn't seem like it was going to be enough for me to put in the work that I wanted to put in, my prayer also. So I stayed and prayed with the elders, prayed with the people, and then I left. When I left, I didn't want to leave because of the ceremony, but I had to go. So, you know, and we told the people that we would return, and, you know, so we did. We came back again, this time last week. We didn't get to quite stay as long as we had hoped, but, you know, the weather changed. It got very cold. So here we are, you know. I believe in the prayer. You know, I believe the prayer helped change people's decision on the pipeline. I feel like it's not over. You know, our elected president is going to push that pipeline through without regard to human life. You know, he's not a believer in the environment. You know, this man is all about money. And this pipeline is all about money. They don't care about your water, my water, or anybody. All they care about is this money.
Do you think that you'll be going out again to Standing Rock because you feel yes. that the fight is not over?
Yes. We're planning another convoy or trip, whichever first, take supplies and return to, you know, help the people and support and with that prayer.
We've heard that many people have left the camp due to the inclement weather. How many people do you think have stayed behind?
I think there's 3,000 still in camp, maybe more. You know, Mr. Archambault, the chairman, he wrote a letter. I didn't see the letter, but it was my understanding he had asked the people to depart from the camp if you weren't ready for the cold. You know, if you're not ready for the minus 15 degrees, then there's no sense in you being out there because you're no good to anybody if you have to go to the hospital or you need medical treatment.
But there's people who are remaining there. You said you think there's about 3,000 people there. Do you,
yes.
as somebody who's been there, do you think it's necessary for people to stay behind even though David Archambault II has asked people to leave?
I think it's necessary. And like I stated earlier, if by it not being over, you know, they're not going to take that pipeline and move it 20 miles through Bismarck because Bismarck, North Dakota, city council already disapproved that decision for fear of contaminating their water, you know. So where are they really going to push it? They're going to keep on going where they're going, you know. Mark my words, this thing is not over. I think it's necessary that the people stay.
For the KBOO News, I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
A federal judge halted the recount vote in Michigan last night, but recounts in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Nevada continue. Three voters in the state of Florida have filed a lawsuit arguing that voting machines were hacked or malfunctioning. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with the attorney representing the complainants in the case, Clint Curtis, about the concerns surrounding the election results in Florida.
A good hacker can do it. Now, a lot of people are saying the Russians are involved because the FBI found that the Russians had penetrated a lot of the voter databases, which is actually where they store the information of the name of the voter, the party of the voter, their address, and their voting history, whether they vote or not. That's essentially a very dangerous tell, because once you know who's going to vote and who's not going to vote, most likely, and you can do this very simply by simply looking at their voting pattern, you can then vote those people whether they voted or not. And in Florida, we've had a lot of people who have complained that they went to vote and were told they couldn't vote because they'd already voted according to the database, which means if they didn't vote, something or someone voted for them.
What do they do? What do they do then? Can they go? Talk to an administrator and have their actual status checked?
Well, there's no way to check it.
Oh, I suppose
because you're not marked to your ballot. So let's say you go and you vote, right?
Yeah.
Or someone goes pretending to be you, or the machine goes and pretends to be you. You know, some code in there just changed the database and says they voted, and by the way, it's a Trump vote this time. So they could do that. If they did that, then all they know is that a ballot is there from someone, something, and maybe the ballot isn't there if it's not a physical ballot, if it's just an electronic image. The ballot is there, and the person is checked off. They can never tie that ballot back to that person. So when they come in to vote, even though they didn't vote the first time, they now look like they voted, and there's no way to find out what ballot they was voted for them, so you can take it back out of the system.
So during the recount, under these circumstances, I suppose, how would they recount and come up with a different number? How do they check the recount? These machines, the touch screens.
Well, the DREs, like the ones in Pennsylvania, where you have no paper record of the vote.
Yeah.
You cannot recount them. It is impossible to do anything but have the machine tell you what it told you the first time. Now, if you had a hacker go in or have code put in there that actually flips the database, the machine will read that database. That's all the machine does. It doesn't really know. It reads a database and says, this is the numbers that I have. Ask me again tomorrow, I'll tell you the same thing. The numbers I have. And so that's really the way it works. There is a way to check it, but it's very tedious, it's very time-consuming, and I don't even know if they'd accept the results. And that's to find precincts that are totally upside down. You know, if you go into, you could do a comparison precinct. There are precincts in Pennsylvania that had zero votes for Romney back in 2012. That's pretty suspect in itself. I mean, I can't believe he'd get zero votes out of a precinct. I would have wanted to check it then, but let's say that's what it shows. And the precinct this time shows 55% for Trump. Okay? You can now have a target. You can go into that precinct, get affidavits from the voters, ask him how they voted. I mean, it's voluntary. They could say, I'm not going to tell you. But if they want their vote to count, it's in their best interest to tell you. And if they show that they did not vote 55% for Trump, and you could find the numbers pretty quickly, then you would have a prima facie case that something is wrong.
I'll say. Yeah.
The key is we have to get rid of these machines, and we have to start counting the paper ballots. You can't just send them through a scanner and say your job is done, because the scanner can lie to you just like the touchscreen.
It's easier
because you don't have to play with the interface. You only have to play with the database. Michigan, I was just speaking with someone from Michigan not that long ago, about an hour before, and about half of the ballot boxes, the actual, you know, things that were storing the ballot, they have little seals on them.
Yeah.
The seals were broken, replaced. They have problems. So in the wisdom of the state, what they are saying is that since these ballots can no longer be trusted, we're not going to let you count them. So it's like, we screwed up, so you accept our results.
Yeah, yeah. I would think that would be a reason why you would want. If you see a ballot box with a seal broken, your first thought is, let's take a look, you know?
Let's take a look and see what's in there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. If someone took the vote, there must be something of interest in there. If you don't just do that as you know, random sort of vandalism on ballot boxes, I wouldn't think.
They're validating their running of the election based on the fact that they ran it so poorly. Which is, you know, yeah, mind-boggling. It's like, okay, you couldn't even control the chain of custody, and now you want us to accept your results. And a judge in Michigan has stopped the recount right now, and they're presently in court again, fighting over whether they can now count ballots since so many ballots are ruined.
This week marks 10 years since Mexico's former president, Felipe Calderón, militarized the so-called war on drugs, deploying troops to carry out law enforcement duties in his home state. Since then, tens of thousands have disappeared, more than 100,000 have been killed, and accusations of human rights abuses carried out by both organized crime groups and the country's security forces continue to mount. Now the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, and his party are pushing for a legal measure to grant the military even more policing and spying powers, stoking fears that more violence and insecurity is to come. Free Speech Radio News' Clayton Kahn brings us more from Mexico City.
At a ceremony to commemorate the 106th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, Mexico's president, top lawmakers, and ranking military brass praised the role of the country's armed forces in combating organized crime. Navy Secretary Vidal Soberan Sanz urged the population to stand behind the military, which increasingly has come under fire for alleged human rights abuses.
It is necessary for the three branches of government, political parties, and society as a whole to join forces in all areas to end all that is damaging to us as a nation. That is the only way to avoid more victims.
Soberón Sanz says the military supports a recent proposal made by members of the ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, that will make permanent extraordinary powers granted to the armed forces. Called the Interior Security Law, the legislation seeks to further erase the legal line between military and civilian law enforcement duties.
Nos unimos a la intención de formular un marco jurídico.
We support the proposal to formulate a legal framework that will prevent this state of uncertainty in which soldiers, pilots, and sailors have remained, that there be legal certainty to our actions and the legal vacuum ruled out.
Human rights defenders criticized the proposal, calling it a means to normalize a state of exception declared 10 years ago when former President Felipe Calderón deployed the military throughout the country for the stated purpose of fighting organized crime. Former head of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, Emilio Álvarez y Casa, says the armed forces need to stay out of domestic law enforcement.
The army, a soldier, is being trained in the extreme use of force, how to kill an enemy. That's why they are for. We need them for national security. And we pay for armies because of that. But it's not a policeman.
According to Article 28 of the proposed law, the military will also be granted greater surveillance powers previously deemed illegal and unconstitutional. For digital rights lawyer Gisela Perez de Acha, this would further diminish the already limited toolbox for defending human and civil rights in Mexico.
If they can already do pretty much anything, and we are going to legalize the surveillance faculties for them, online and offline, the problematic thing will be that we will not have the capabilities as citizens to push back against that. And we have more of that within against the police.
Since Calderón militarized the nation's public security strategy a decade ago, the official number of identified drug cartels has more than doubled. Meanwhile, the number of disappeared persons has risen to just under 30,000, a toll comparable to that of Argentina's dirty war. The death toll is even higher, with an estimated 186,000 fatalities, according to official numbers. When confronted with those bleak statistics, officials tend to point fingers at violent criminals. But international human rights organizations have extensively documented police and military involvement in enforced disappearances and extrajudicial executions. Araceli Rodriguez, whose son was disappeared in 2009, echoes a common sentiment among victims' families.
If those whom we entrust to protect us, take care of us, investigate crimes, are not doing that, Well, they should face exemplary punishment, because not one public servant has been made an example of. That is why they continue with all this foolishness. That is why they continue to associate with the narcos, and it's why they continue to disappear people.
Impunity is the rule in Mexico, even in the exceptional cases in which allegations of corruption or human rights abuses are investigated. Even when carrying out civilian police duties, the armed forces are only accountable to a military court system. Policy analyst Laura Carlson argues that legislative proposals that fall short of systemic change will be ineffective in stopping the cycle of Mexico's violence and insecurity.
Everyone pretends like the problem is just getting the right formula of who's in charge or of changing around the agency or of having the United States Merit Initiative come in and do training with these people. And it has nothing to do with these people. And it has to do with political will. As long as political will government as long as it's benefiting both on the individual level of corrupt officials and on the institutional level of structural corruption and complicity from the lucrative drug trade, we're not going to see any changes.
Although Mexican lawmakers and the country's Defense Department say passage of the Interior Security Law is a top priority, political observers predict it is unlikely to occur in the current legislative session that ends in mid-December. Yet, 10 years after the militarization of the drug war, soldiers in the streets has become the new normal in many parts of Mexico. Clayton Khan, FSRN, Mexico City.
An arms race between Russia and the West continues to simmer in Eastern Europe. Commercial satellite images analyzed by the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies appear to show Russia moving a new generation of ballistic missiles into the Baltic region. The Iskander missile system is known as the Son of Scud and is nuclear capable. Russia appears to be basing the system in Kaliningrad Oblast, a wedge of land between Poland and Lithuania that has been under Russian control since World War II. Basing the Iskander system there puts more of Europe within range of Russian missiles. Of course, Russia is not the only power ferreting missiles away in Eastern Europe. The U.S., in addition to systems already in place, recently installed ballistic missiles in Romania, and there are plans to move more into Poland. U.S. Brigadier General Peter Zwack, quoted by NPR, says that while having Iskander missiles in Kaliningrad sends a message to NATO and the U.S., it doesn't change much since Russia already has nuclear-capable missiles dotting the region. If they go into tactical mode, he said, it's the end of the world anyway.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Chris Andre and Joe Lino. The producer is myself, Sam Bowman. Special thanks to our friends at Free Speech Radio News, found at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The acting KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenna Yokoyama, filling in for Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting. Ani and Lynn take your calls. At 9, Beloved Community brings you Larry Brilliant and his story. Sometimes Brilliant, the impossible adventure of a spiritual seeker and visionary physician who helped conquer the worst disease in history. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. And at 11, on a special episode of Digital Divide, a conversation with Howard Bloom, author of The God Problem. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. A reminder that all new and increased gifts to KBOO are matched one-to-one through the end of the year, thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Go to kboo.fm and click Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The days following the presidential results saw protesters taking to the streets of Portland. While some people protest with rallying cries and speeches, others prefer a more melodic approach. This weekend, Portlanders looking to take action through singing can attend a free community training that's being called the Radical Chorus Workshop and Skillshare. KBOO's Aaron Yankee spoke with Mo Bowstern to talk in depth about this weekend's event.
Hi, I'm Aaron Yankee, and I'm here today with Mo Bowstern, who is one of the organizers of the Radical Chorus Workshop and Skillshare that KBOO is co-sponsoring this Sunday at Revolution Hall that will begin at 3 p.m. Hi, Mo.
Hi, Aaron.
Can you tell us a little bit about what to expect on Sunday for the Radical Chorus Skillshare and Workshop?
Sure. It's divided into three parts. I'll talk for a little bit, maybe 20 minutes or so, about the history of the Amalgamated Everlasting Union Chorus, Local 824, a protest chorus that I and many other people have sung in Portland from the late 90s until the early part of this century. So I'll go over the history of the chorus itself, and then we'll be calling up former chorus members to join me at the front of the room, and we'll do a 30-minute question and answer period with the audience participating, focused on how to stay safe at a protest and how to operate within an affinity group and experiences people are curious about. We definitely have a lot of things to share about how to stay brave and have a sense of humor at times when you're not feeling like you're supported in the world. And then the final part of the workshop and Skillshare will be the actual Skillshare part, where we'll be singing several songs out of a songbook that everybody who comes will get.